All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Everyone. It's nice to see you all out here today. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Lawrer and Judge Jaquith, and we're here today for the matter of David W. Berenger versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 23-7995. And before we get started, I just want to note that we're hearing this case today from the DAV National Headquarters, that's Disabled American Veterans National Headquarters in Erlanger, Kentucky. And we want to thank DAV for hosting this oral argument. It's very good-natured of them to let us talk, have an argument before all of you. And I also wanted to note that we do have, we're pleased that we have the veteran with us today, David W. Berenger. And Mr. Berenger is here in the front row. And so we're very pleased that you could join us, Mr. Berenger. Now we're going to move on to argument. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Zachary Stoltz for the appellant. With me at counsel table is Elizabeth Rowland from the law firm Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz.
David LeBlanc and Deputy Chief Amanda Haddock for the secretary.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you, Mr. LeBlanc. And as you know, you each have 30 minutes to argue. And Mr. Stoltz, how much time would you like to reserve?
10 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Okay. And you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. The August 2022 rating decision in this case is an AMA decision. Pursuant to the AMA Public Law Section 2X, Mr. Berenger is entitled to all applicable provisions of the Appeals Modernization Act, including the effective date provisions of 38 U.S.C. Section 5110A2D. Because this decision was made as a result of the supplemental claim that Mr. Berenger filed within 1 year of the October 2021 board decision, the claim of entitlement to an earlier effective date for the award of TDIU has been continuously pursued. The board committed its error at page 8 of the record when it completed its analysis with a conclusion that its October 2021 decision was issued in the legacy system, and that therefore Mr. Berenger was prohibited from filing a freestanding claim for an earlier effective date under this court's Rudd decision. Rather than citing Rudd and concluding that there can be no freestanding claim for an earlier effective date, the board should have adjudicated Mr. Berenger's case as continuously pursued pursuant to the provisions of the AMA.
Now, if we would find for Mr. Berenger here, wouldn't it be that he's kind of getting his cake and eating it too? I don't really know the genesis of that that phrase, but he got the benefit of duty to assist throughout the VA appeals process here initially, mm-hmm. and also got the benefit of very lenient evidence submission rules. So those are part of the legacy system. And now he or any claimant in his position would be trying to tag onto that the beneficial parts of the AMA, the you know, specifically the continuous pursuit allowance.
Yes, Your Honor.
So,
That's true. That is how it would work in practice, is that, but that's the way it was designed because of the way that legacy and AMA ran concurrently up until, and still in some sense does run, do run concurrently. But the public law is clear on its face. It's a plain language. And whether, and Congress clearly intended, because of the language they chose in that public law, that all claims that the AOJ issues after February of 2019 are in the AMA. And so the way to think about this is, yes, Mr. Berenger would get the protections that he was afforded in the legacy system, as well as the new improved protections in many ways of the Appeals Modernization Act. But that is what Congress intended. It really cannot be otherwise. It's an interesting situation, because there's no question that the AOJ decision from August of 2022 is in the AMA. That's not even really at issue in the case. And so if that's an AMA case, then he, it's some version of 38 United States Code 5110 applies. So that's the analysis that I would encourage the court to undertake. And the version of 5110 that must apply to something after February of 2019 has to be the new version of 5110, and the new version of 5110 has the provisions for continuous pursuit.
And so the fact that on page 3829 of the record, he received this notice saying opt-ins, they were telling him about opting in. Mm-hmm. In his SSOC, in the initial SSOC, that it says opt-ins will not be accepted if received after the Board of Veterans Appeals has issued a decision on your legacy appeal.
Yes, that's what it says. And opt-in was certainly the method that many veterans chose, but there are two methods provided by law. And he did not opt in. That is true. I think he was given, the secretary cited it a number of times, to opt in. He didn't for his reasons. He stayed in the legacy system. But there are two ways, essentially, there are three ways, but two basic ways to get into the AMA. You either opt in along the way, or there's a decision after February. There's an AOJ, I should say, decision, because Maddox answers the question of the board decision. But if there's an AOJ decision after February 2019, that's another way in. So whether he chose or did not choose under the provisions of the AMA, the statute controls here, and the public law controls. And Congress's clear intent is for him to be in the AMA. And if he's in the AMA, he's entitled to that version of 5110.
So, Mr. Stoltz, your argument is a very narrow one, and it relies solely on Section 2X of the AMA. Is there any other statutory provision that you would rely on?
The way the statutes work, the ticket to ride is Public Law 2X, but that triggers the entire statutory framework and the amendments that the AMA ushered in, and that's exactly what the public law says. And so the statutory framework of the AMA works in harmony with Public Law 2X, but that's the trigger into the AMA that Mr. Berenger is relying on in the case.
So there's no argument that after the legacy decision was made that the appellant pursued either the opt-in or a request for board reconsideration or an appeal to the court.
That's correct. Right? He filed a supplemental claim. He filed a 995.
Okay. So
he filed in this case, also very interesting, he filed a 995, filed a supplemental claim, did what he was supposed to do under the statutory framework of the AMA, filed the 995. It is a supplemental claim. VA took that, adjudicated it all the way through. Didn't the AOJ didn't say, no, you can't have a freestanding claim. The AOJ adjudicated it on its merits.
So that's a processing. So that conceivably, the AOJ could have decided not to process it if, for example, there was not new and material or new and relevant evidence here.
It could have.
So, but that's a processing as opposed to the merits of the contesting the effective date for the TDIU.
Yes, the AOJ could have done that. It didn't. And so, yes, that's a processing and gets us to a merits determination because it itself undertook it. The AOJ itself undertook a merits adjudication.
What's the effect of the veteran's choice to pursue a lane under the modernized system? What effect does that have on the relationship between the supplemental claim and the October 2021 board decision?
The practical effect that it has, the way that this case developed, is that if he were found to be in the legacy system, Rudd would be triggered. But because the effect is that he's continuously pursuing his claim going back to the original claim, which the board mentioned was filed in 2013. So that's the practical effect, is he may be entitled to 3 more years of TDIU benefits at the very least.
And so to you, the statute, that little part of the statutory language means that the distinct lanes that the veteran could choose, either to stay in legacy, or lane is probably not a very good way to describe it because we use that in other contexts under the AMA, but these two systems that VA had. So the law kind of seemed to, otherwise, other than the phrase that you're honing in on, seemed to set up two different systems, legacy and AMA. And it even defined what opting in is. It defined what legacy is. So it was clearly trying to distinguish between the two and how a veteran might get from one to the other. Is there anything else in the statute? Because, of course, we can't look at just a few words of the statute. I mean, sometimes, of course, that is the answer to the entire case. But often we look at the whole statute in context and all the pieces and how it's working together to make sure it makes sense.
Well, it does make sense. It does make sense. In fact, I would submit that it makes less sense to go with what the Secretary pled in his brief. Because to go that way, and I know that the statutory framework, there is a clear legacy statutory framework and a clear AMA. There's really no definition of legacy. That's just kind of a thing we all called it. And so I would say that Public Law 2X has a major trigger in it, and it's February 19 of 2019. That is when the AMA starts, right? That's when we're in that world. And so the Secretary's argument, As I worked on this case, started to make less sense to me than the way that it worked for Mr. Berenger, because if you follow his, you kind of just ignore this major provision. And I know it's in one, that the trigger is in one statute, but it is read in harmony with 5110 and 5104. All of that reads harmoniously if you follow Mr. Berenger's argument. It falls apart under VA's argument because I don't want to put words in their mouth, but the way that I understand the argument, and I know that my friend will get up and explain, and I'll have a chance on rebuttal if I'm wrong, but if I understand the Secretary's argument, it's once the legacy board decision was made, into legacy he remained forever. Even though he filed something after the major trigger date of February 2019 of the AMA, the Appeals Modernization Act. And so I suppose my understanding is in the Secretary's version of events, the AOJ would have made this decision and said, no, old 5110 applies to you. But why would old 5110, legacy 5110, apply after February of 2019 at the AOJ?
Well, couldn't the Secretary have said not what you said they said, that you're still in legacy, but you're in the AMA, but continuous pursuit, that continuous pursuit part of legacy won't apply to your effective date determination here.
It absolutely could have, in which case it would have read out 5110. It would have done exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. It would have read out a provision of 5110. It would have read out a statutory provision because they wanted to. I mean, essentially, that's it. I don't really, and I'm happy to, you know, answer more on rebuttal after we hear from the Secretary. But in reading the pleadings, I don't really know what law they're relying on to say, no, in this case, old 5110 applies, even at the AOJ. Maddox answers the question of the board. We're not debating what happened at the board. That was a legacy board decision, and Maddox talks about that. And so old 5110 you know, wouldn't have applied there if it came up as a freestanding claim, but it came up as pursued. But it just doesn't make sense for the AOJ to just say, well, because this is an earlier effective date claim, Rudd and old 5110, when if it had been another type of claim, a service connection or an increased rating claim, you know, I think that they would have been able to just trigger it off of the supplemental claim.
So are you saying that the supplemental claim is the beginning of a new claim stream instead of the latest step in the legacy claim stream?
I would say that the 995 is a continuation. It's all one case. Mr. Berenger has been consistently seeking this benefit for over a decade. And so it's not necessarily that it started a new claim. It's that it's supplemented, which is what the law says. It's an exquisitely called supplemental claim. It supplemented what he had been doing under the new legal framework provided for by Congress. And so it's not necessarily a new claim. It continued his case because he was entitled to, and to Judge Lauer's point, it's not just to a public law 2X, it's also 5110. He's entitled to under 5110. And when he filed that supplemental claim, he was entitled to 5104 notice and all of the provisions of the AMA. That doesn't appear to be in dispute here, that he's in the AMA after February 2019. We all know that. He's in the AMA. He has to be. It's not a legacy case anymore because he's in the new world. He's, you know, when it turns to Technicolor and he's in AMA.
Why did anyone ever opt in then? I understand what you're saying. And there appears to be definitely, you know, a basis for your argument. But it kind of begs the question, like when you read the statute as a whole, the statute mentions opting in. Like, why would someone do it whenever the old system technically was more favorable in terms of duty to assist evidence? I guess maybe for the quickness that the AMA promised, is that what you're thinking or something else?
This is some speculation, but having worked in the system, I, in working on this case and on others, I appreciate that Congress gave basically two ways in. It's not that Congress said only if you opt in. It also gave this provision that if you file a supplemental claim, if there's an AOJ decision after 2019, that is another way to get in. There could be any number of reasons to stay in legacy. As it worked out, looking back up the river, you know, the legacy cases worked a little bit faster, even though the AMA was. There's a lot of bureaucratic. There are a lot of bureaucratic things that happen that were unintended consequences. There could be any number of choices for a veteran to want to stay in the legacy. Veteran may have felt, look, I've come this far in this system, let's stay here. There could be any number of reasons. It doesn't really matter why he or she would not opt into the AMA when there is this clear statutory trigger to get into it after the board decision, or really after any decision. If you want to get into the AMA, if the AOJ issues this decision, you're in.
So under your theory, what limits, if any, are there for supplemental claims when it raises a challenge to a final effective date by a board in the legacy decision? Are there any limits?
The plain language of 5110. If Mr. Berenger had filed this after a year of the board decision, he would not be able to continue. He would not be in continuous pursuit.
Okay.
And so it'd still be a supplemental claim. He would not be in, he would go, it would just be the plain language of the statute. The statute, again, reads, once you get through the somewhat counterintuitive, the kind of reaction of, no, he must be in legacy, which I think, you know, I will just say I shared when I read this case. It's like, oh, no, he must be in legacy. Oh, but wait, this is the way the statute reads. It's just 5110. You just keep going through the statutes. There's nothing that gets really bizarre or remains counterintuitive at all. If he filed it outside of the year of the board decision, he'd be under 50. He'd still be 5110, but he'd not be entitled to the continuous pursuit.
And let me ask you this. As you know, the secretary earlier this month, I think it was June 10th, submitted a Rule 30B notification about a single judge decision, which may be used persuasively. Obviously, it's not precedent in the Purcell case. How would you square the holding of that case with your theory in this case?
It's a little hard to square because I see why the secretary would submit that as supplemental authority. In that case, the facts are different. There's not a clean AOJ decision that would trigger 2X. Nevertheless, I read Purcell to be relatively close to what the argument Mr. Berenger is making. I would say, however, that the court in that case really didn't deal with public law 2X or 5110 and the statutory framework. It didn't answer the questions in the way, it's non-precedential, and didn't answer the questions in the way that Mr. Berenger has presented them to this court today. And so I would encourage the court to put it in its proper place as persuasive, but it's not as persuasive as the statutory plain language and the way that Mr. Berenger's case proceeded through and was pled before this court.
But there are similarities in terms of having a final decision in the legacy system and then raising a supplemental claim under the AMA after February 2019.
Yes.
So you responded to Judge Lara a minute ago. His question of whether if the veteran hadn't filed a supplemental within a year, I think something like that, and you said, he would be an AMA, but he wouldn't get the continuous pursuit part.
That's 5110.
Right, but you were just telling me like you see continuous pursuit as kind of separable from the other parts of the AMA?
No, it's all part of the AMA. But there are provisions. That's exactly what the AMA provides. It's all part of the AMA. It depends on timing. Under the AMA, if you come within the date triggers, so if you file within a year of a board decision, a year of a court of appeals for veterans claims decision, right? If you file from the AOJ, you pick your lanes. There's all these different mechanisms in the AMA. If Mr. Berenger had filed outside of the year, AMA still applies. He would file a supplemental claim. But the AOJ, I would imagine, would say, yeah, this is a supplemental claim. We'll adjudicate it, but you're outside of the year, and so you haven't continuously pursued it. Still in the AMA, it's just whatever 5110 says, which, again, I'd like to circle back to Judge Lauer's initial question to me. It's not just 2X. It's also 5110, 5108, 5104, all of those provisions. Everything gets read in harmony under Mr. Berenger's theory of this case.
But your answer indicates that at least continuous pursuit can be screened out from some cases.
You follow the statute.
Yeah, well, I get it. But nevertheless, that's perhaps giving some credence to the secretary's argument here.
In my opinion, Your Honor, it's showing the strength of our argument. Because if we're both saying that new 5110 applies, if that's what we're both saying, and again, I would never put words in the secretary's mouth, but if I understand that we are both saying that new 5110 applies, then Mr. Berenger is in within the year of the board decision. And he's got the AOJ decision that came out after February of 2019. And so he's good. He's good to go on pursuing that earlier effective date. Had Mr. Berenger waited until day 366 after this board decision filed, still think it's a supplemental claim, still think it's fine to go in under file a 995 and have VA adjudicate it, but they would look to 5110 and say, no, your effective date provision can't date back to your original claim stream. This is something, to Judge Jaquith's point, that is, that is new and goes off on that direction. That's just the point. That's just the way the AMA works. It has not. It's not that it's some kind of a workaround or way to game the system. That's just the way 5110 reads.
So, the way you envision it, in the immediate aftermath of the October 2021 board decision, the veteran had the option to file a supplemental claim and invoke the AMA or appeal the legacy decision to the court.
Yes.
Or file a motion for reconsideration.
Yes, Your Honor.
All those.
Just like when the board issues a decision today, those are the options that a veteran is going to have. If there's a denial or a disagreement with the board's adjudication. That's the same situation that every veteran all of the thousands that are going to be processed today, exact same situation for all of them would apply to Mr. Berenger.
What about the notion that in context, the supplemental claim could be a claim to reopen that couldn't result in an earlier effective date? It would just be the date of the supplemental claim.
That would fly. Again, that would be a way to read the case in which 38 USC 5110 just didn't apply. And that doesn't make any sense. That actually is to me the nonsensical reading of the statutory framework under the AMA.
Why do you think that the August 2022 rating decision is the operative initial decision here rather than the June 2014 rating decision denying TDIU or the June 2021 rating decision granting TDIU effective February 25th, 2016?
I'm not sure that I would use the word operative, although as we cited in our briefing, the held case talks a little bit to this, that the initial decision is the one in the AMA to start in on the AMA to in that case, it was an attorney fees case, so it's not on all fours with this case, but it gives some guidance. But it's not really the operative, to use your honor's word. The operative, there are several operative dates in this. The operative is date of the initial claim in 2013, the operative first decision in legacy, but the decision that triggers, if you will, the Appeals Modernization Act protections and new 5110 is, that would be the operative decision. It's the operative decision to start the AMA process up. And that would be true whether it came in within a year or came outside of a year. That would be true no matter when it was filed. If it was filed after, if that AOJ decision, I shouldn't say filed, that would be true as long as the AOJ decision postdated the date prescribed by Congress, February of 2019. That, no matter when you're in the AMA, then start doing the work.
So that could be the June 2021 rating decision could still trigger the AMA.
It could trigger the AMA, but then you get into all the different lanes and streams and all of that kind of stuff.
So Congress anticipated having both systems for an indefinite period of time with fewer legacy cases eventually. But in Maddox, there was a warning that the court gave about collapsing the two into one. And for all intents and purposes, the appellant's theory of this case would act, the supplemental claim here would act as a notice of appeal to the court for effective purposes. Would you agree?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If I'm following your question, what the veteran did here, everybody did, aside from granting of the claim, which I would take issue with, of course, VA did everything right in this case, adjudicatory, as far as the procedure. VA, the AOJ did everything right. So it's not taken as an appeal to the court. It's taken as it was meant to be, a supplemental claim, which the AOJ then read and adjudicated on its merits. AOJ did fine. I would have granted it, of course, Mr. Berenger's here, aside from its denial, what it did procedurally was right. And then he chose a hearing. Everything was fine. We were in the AMA. We were following what Congress was doing. Everything was moving down the tracks correctly. And then the board got it and cited Rudd and kicked it out. That is why we needed to appeal to the court so that we could fix the legal mistake in the case.
Okay, but if you're following along with the holding in Rudd, which was pre-AMA, of course, and you were using Maddox as your guide to decide when is it a legacy versus a modernized case, you could look at this, and I realize that this is not the appellant's theory or mm-hmm. view, but you could look at this as another bite at the legacy apple here in treating the supplemental claim after arguably you've had a final decision under the legacy system, of using the supplemental claim effectively as a notice of appeal, which does not meet the facts here.
It does not meet the facts here. Theoretically, yes, Your Honor, but that doesn't meet the facts here. He's outside of the 120 days here, but he's within the year. The Maddox case, I understand why the secretary would cite Maddox, because there is so much in there about the two different systems and the opting in. But Maddox doesn't answer this question. Maddox doesn't answer what happens after there's an AOJ, after VA does the right thing and issues an AOJ decision in the AMA process.
I mean, if it did, we wouldn't be seeing
right. But it came close. But this is really, you know, this is a very interesting, you know, set of circumstances that Maddox, you know, doesn't apply to. Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, Purcell. Again, a non-precedential case, single judge decision is much closer to what we have here.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. There are no further questions. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, but I'm.
Yeah, we'll make it. We'll settle it. Secretary Scott.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Bartley, and may it please the court. The court should affirm the board's dismissal in this case for two principal reasons. First, the board finally adjudicated entitlement to an earlier effective date for TDIU in the October 21 legacy board decision, a fact the appellant concedes. And second, as explained in Calhoun, final effective date determinations cannot be re-adjudicated except under limited circumstances. And so the board was correct in the decision on appeal to find the April 22 supplemental claim was an impermissible freestanding earlier effective date claim because filing a supplemental claim cannot vitiate the finality of a final effective date claim determination.
And didn't VA explicitly say in promulgating its AMA rules that a claimant must file a supplemental claim to seek review of a finally adjudicated claim?
That's right. And in the provisions under 3.160E and in 3.156, I believe, D, and what Judge Bartley said in Calhoun and we said in our supplemental brief was that the supplemental claim is going to replace the claim to reopen. So it is an option once a claim becomes final, but as explained in Calhoun and in Rudd, once a final effective date determination is rendered, it cannot be re-adjudicated except for by showing a clear and unmistakable error, a motion for reconsideration, or a motion to vacate. And that's a supplemental claim is none of those things. And so when the April 22 supplemental claim was filed, that day it was an impermissible freestanding earlier effective date claim. And so the board was correct to dismiss it as such.
Now, it was kind of confusing that VA didn't catch this a little earlier because, you know, Mr. Berenger went through the entire board hearing. It was all about the merits of the effective date of TDIU. And I think it was different board members holding, you know, deciding the case and holding the hearing. What to make of that? It was though he was in the AMA track with no repercussions that the board decision was legacy. I found it a little bit confusing.
It is. The system in this case worked as intended, which was the board in the decision recognized an error in processing the claim. And instead of denying it, dismissed it because as was stated in Calhoun, there's no authority for the board to act on a claim other than a Q claim for re-adjudicating an effective date. So while yes, it could have been caught earlier, the system is designed for the board to correct errors made earlier in the process. And so whenever the board was adjudicating this claim, they recognized the fact that the appellant did not take any of the options available to him following a legacy board decision and dismiss the claim as it was bound to do by this court and the Federal Circuit's cases. And with what was said earlier, I think it's critical to read the statute in context. And when you look at 2X1, the entire quote of it, the provision starts with except as otherwise provided in this subsection. And later in that subsection in 2X5, there is a section that says treatment of legacy claims. And it says that when legacy claims want to join the AMA, they may do so after receiving an SOC or an SSOC. And then later in the AMA Act, in the public law, in the definition section, it defines what a legacy claim is. And a legacy claim is one that has received notice under 5104 prior to the effective date in 2019. So that is why they had to say that the October 21 ended a legacy claim stream. So there's no dispute that this claim was a legacy claim. Where we part ways is what the April 22 supplemental claim means. And because that is not an option for re-adjudicating final effective date determinations, the proper recourse was to dismiss the appeal.
Doesn't the board's acknowledgement that the veteran had filed a supplemental claim under the AMA as a request for review of the October 2021 board decision indicate that the board recognized that the veteran had opted into the modernized system, at least implicitly?
As appellant said in his opening argument, that's not what they're arguing. They're not arguing that this was a late opt-in or anything of that nature. They're saying that this was a permissible review option, which there is no mechanism in the law that says that that is the case. So it is only, as Judge Lyle pointed out, an argument under 2X1. They say that the reading of all claims with decisions after the effective date means that this claim was converted into an AMA claim. And I think your point a second ago, Judge Jaquith, is what Judge Greenberg said in Purcell, is that this filing of a supplemental claim creates a new claim stream. And so the effective date under 5110, the legacy version, or 5110 A1 and A3, the date of the claim can be the effective date of the claim can be no earlier than the date it was received. And so that's what happened in Purcell. That veteran was denied service connection, and whenever he filed his supplemental claim, he was later granted and then sought an earlier effective date for that service connection grant. And the analysis was, well, this claim was final when you filed your supplemental claim, so the effective date can be no earlier than the date of claim. And that's why freestanding earlier effective date claims are impermissible, because whenever you file a request for an earlier effective date, whenever you already have an effective date earlier than that, there is no relief that can be granted. That's the analysis that was done in Rudd, and that's the analysis that was done in Calhoun, whenever the court explained in that AMA claimants have an option not available to legacy claimants of filing a supplemental claim within a year of a board or a court decision and potentially securing an earlier effective date. That's not an option for legacy claimants. They have 120 days to take an appeal to this court, and then after that 120 days expires, that is whenever finality attaches. And so once finality attaches, those decisions cannot be re-adjudicated absent a showing of clear and unmistakable error, a motion to reconsider, or a motion to vacate. And appellant concedes that his supplemental claim is none of those things. So the court should agree with the board's analysis in this case that the proper recourse was to dismiss the appeal.
What's the impact of the RO's adjudication of the supplemental claim on the merits? Doesn't that show that the RO found that VA had the authority to adjudicate the supplemental claim? And as such, does it constitute a finding on the application of law to facts that's favorable to the appellant and binding on the board?
Again, not an argument appellant makes, but to the extent that it might be, it was a denial. So it wasn't a favorable finding. There was never any indication. Mr. Behringer has never been given notice by VA that a supplemental claim was going to be an option after his legacy appeal became final. And that's how it's been for all legacy claimants since the system was created. And once the AMA was passed, the opt-in procedures, the opt-in notices were started to be disseminated, and Mr. Behringer got a couple of those. And in the last one, it was one of the explicit benefits that are noted in the opt-in is that you could potentially preserve your initial effective date. There's never been an indication that there would be another opportunity to do that later, to have the benefits of the AMA applied to a legacy claim. And I think it's on point to say that to accept that argument, you're getting the benefits of both systems, which is not what Congress set up. They set up these systems to run concurrently, and then if legacy claimants wanted to, and as was stated earlier, there are benefits to staying in the legacy system. There's still the duty to assist at the board. There are looser standards for submitting evidence and argument prior to the board's decision, and so Mr. Barringer took that option, and then he got notice after the October 21 legacy board decision of his options, and none of those options were a supplemental claim in continuous pursuit of his effective date. And so, as the court said in Lloyd, continuous pursuit is a creation of the AMA and nothing more. It's not something that can be reached into from the legacy system.
You overstated that a little bit. He did get notice of supplemental claim as an option. That it didn't say anything about continuous pursuit, but it was on the menu of choices that he could make.
After the SSOC, yes. After the July 21 partial grant, there was an SSOC that was issued. And in there, it said that within the time for filing a substantive appeal, which is 60 days, you could file a supplemental claim or any of the options under 3.2500 and opt into the AMA. But once that window closed, then it was off the table. And so that's whenever legacy claimants get the chance to join the AMA. And then if you file one after a claim becomes filed, then you are creating a new claim stream, and the effective date then turns on the date the claim was received. And so this is the system that Congress created, and the Secretary has carried out. The provisions for applicability are clear, and since Congress specified how opt-ins would be, the presumption is that they didn't intend for there to be others. And so this is not an option to get from one system to the other, because Congress specified how veterans would do so.
So, well,
I'm going to just take you back a ways to something you said about 10 minutes ago, because you've been talking for a while, which is great. But you were referencing the actual public law 115-55, and you were saying that you said something like under X, X said, except as provided in another subsection, these are the rules. And then those are the rules that appellant's counsel was referring to. And then you laid out the definition of opt-in and the definition of legacy, I think. Isn't that in another section, though, of the public law?
It is. It's in the definitions, in Section 6.
In
yes.
The definition. Okay.
The definition of a legacy claim, and then the definition of opt-in is in Section 6.
So can I ask you to just go into this a little bit more? What are you saying is the impact of the definitions and the information in subsection 6? In Section 6.
And so in 2X1, it says except as otherwise provided in this subsection. And so I was referencing there that 2X5 that references how we're, and I think the label is treatment of legacy claims. And so they say,
right,
once the, after the effective date of the AMA, if legacy claimants, after they receive an SOC or an SSOC, they may elect to become into the modernized system. And so my point was that appellants puts a lot of stock in the AMA applying to all claims with decisions after the effective date of the AMA, but that full statement of the law on applicability expressly says, except as otherwise provided in this subsection. That is an indication from Congress that there are exceptions to this rule. And that exception is in 2X5 when it relates to legacy claims. And this is something that Judge Lauer said in Jackson, which was that Congress doesn't make significant policy changes cryptically. And so if they wanted the filing of a continuous pursuit to be one of the ways after a legacy board decision, to be one of the ways that an opt-in was acceptable, they could have said that in the public law or in the statutes that they passed whenever they refined the system, and they didn't do that. And so that is an indication that this is, that the board's analysis was correct. And the analysis in Calhoun leads us to the conclusion in this case, which is that once a legacy appeal becomes final, there are limited options for re-adjudicating that type of claim. And they are clear and unmistakable error, motions to reconsider, or motions to vacate, or the board correcting sua sponte, a clear and obvious error. A supplemental claim is not one of those things. And so when he filed the supplemental claim in April of 22, it was an impermissible freestanding earlier effective date claim that the board correctly dismissed. And it should be noted that Mr. Berenger is not without recourse. Today, tomorrow, any day, he could file a Q claim. He could file a motion to reconsider. He could file a motion to vacate. There are no time limits on any of those options, which is what legacy claimants have as available to them once their determinations in the legacy system become final if they want to get an earlier effective date. And so the statement in Calhoun, I don't think could be any clearer that filing a supplemental claim within a year is not an option for legacy claimants because the time when finality attaches to legacy claims is different. It attaches once the 120 days to file an appeal to this board expires. And once it attaches, then it can't be vitiated aside from those options that I laid out. And that's the distinction between the AMA and the legacy system. If you file within a year, finality never attaches. I think the word the court uses often is forestalls finality. It suspends the attachment of finality for those claims. But in the AMA, which is what the court's conclusion was whenever they were determined whether they had jurisdiction, is that if you file a supplemental claim after that year, it's the same conclusion as it is in the legacy system, which that's a freestanding earlier effective date claim triggering application of the rules espoused in Rudd and in Leonard. And so that is the key fact that this case turns on, is that, and they concede on page 6 of their reply brief, that finality attached in this case. And so that is really the end of the matter in this case.
Mr. Obonke, you seem to be making the argument that there is a distinction under the AMA between processing, and in this case, the supplemental claim was filed after the effective date, or after the date that the AMA went into effect, rather, and the actual jurisdictional issue. Is there distinction in the statute that we can follow to connect the dots there?
Because there is a bar on the class of claims of earlier effective date claims, 5110 under the legacy system and under the AMA prohibits those class of cases. And so not exactly sure if I understand your question fully, but my understanding is that because the system set up to have legacy claims enter the AMA system only through those limited options that Congress laid out in the AMA Act and then charged the secretary with carrying out, which we did in 3.2400C, and then also in 19.2, I believe D is where we spell out how legacy claims can join the AMA and reap the benefits of that of the new system in the same claim stream. And I think that is a point that it should not be overstated, that once the claim becomes final and you file a supplemental claim on it, just like it would be in the legacy, you file a claim to reopen, you are starting a new claim stream. And so what benefits you can get from that, they are limited to the date that the claim was received. And that is, in our view, what was the conclusion in Purcell, that the filing of a supplemental claim following a final court decision in that case, which is a procedural difference that really doesn't matter because it was in both instances final legacy decisions, that filing a supplemental claim after a final legacy decision does not convert the initial claim into an AMA claim to which the AMA provisions apply, including 3.2500, I think it's C and H for continuous pursuit. And so the concept of continuous pursuit attaches to the claim. And so once you get an unfavorable decision in the AMA, you get notice that after this decision, you have a year to take one of the options of taking an appeal to the board, filing a supplemental claim or seeking higher level review. And if a claimant is later successful, then they could potentially preserve their initial effective date back to the date of filing. But that's a different case than this one, because you have an entirely separate claim stream that was finally adjudicated. Whereas like in Held, that claim that the court concluded triggered applicability of the AMA, that was the initial decision on Q. There were no earlier decisions on a Q claim in that case. So it made sense that in that case, the application of the AMA rules were triggered on Q because there had never been another decision on it in that case. And so that is a distinction between this case and Held, where here you have an entirely adjudicated claim stream that was final, and appellate agrees with us on that, and then you have a filing of a claim after finality, and you know the answer that the court has to come with is, what do we do with that? And the court, we think, has already answered that question in Calhoun with the analysis that was done on jurisdiction in that case.
Okay. This sort of goes back to the question that Judge Jaquith asked earlier, and I just want to make sure I understand the Secretary's argument here. So it sounds like you're saying that the AOJ could have, when it received the supplemental claim after the AMA went into effect, that it could have taken care of it at that point and denied. And that's the processing piece of this, right? So instead, this went, you now have the NOD filed and it goes to the board. Am I understanding the argument correctly? And so my question, again, I think you've answered this, but it was just sort of the distinctions in the statute itself.
Yes. When the RO received the April 22 supplemental claim, it could have easily rejected it, because on the day it filed, it was an impermissible freestanding earlier effective date claim because the effective date for that claim had become final. But it accepted it, and whether that's a mistake or not is not really pertinent, because the board is designed to correct those sorts of mistakes. It's designed to recognize things that happened below that perhaps shouldn't have, but in this case, he was never told that a supplemental claim was in continuous pursuit of his initial effective date was going to be an option. And what was said earlier, you know, about Maddox. Maddox is instructive because we have to first, and in the definition of a supplemental claim under the regulations, it says it's going to be a previously filed claim for the same or similar benefits that was previously decided. So the previous decision is relevant to determining what kind of supplemental claim it is, because as we stated in Calhoun, you know, there are those that are in continuous pursuit of the initial effective date that are filed before the claim becomes final, and then there are those that are in replacement of the claim to reopen that will have different effects on the on what the effective date can be for that claim. And so here, the June 2014 initial decision was prior by some time to the effective date of the AMA, which made TDIU a legacy claim that was finally adjudicated ultimately in the October 21 legacy board decision. And so because of that, and because, as has been said, there was no steps taken or choices made to opt in to the AMA when given notice to do so, the finality of the October 21 legacy board decision attached once the time for taking an appeal to this court ended. And that narrowed the options available to the appellant in this case to cue a motion for reconsideration or a motion a motion to vacate. And so
that's pretty far from Maddox, though, isn't it? You know, the veteran's affirmative choice and action in filing an AMA supplemental claim, plus the flurry of board and RO activity. I think there were four different VLJs who took action on this case from 2020 to 2023. So it's pretty far from the concern expressed in Maddox over the notion that even a single VA action on the AMA side of February 19th, 2019 would automatically convert a legacy appeal into an AMA case. There was a lot of activity in the AMA era.
Yes, Your Honor, and we agree with that. Our point about Maddox is the triggering, as you asked earlier, the operative rating decision, and what the analysis that was conducted in Maddox discussed was that when you have a rating decision, an initial decision prior to the effective date, well, that makes it the claim a legacy claim as defined in the public law in Section 6. And we also define a legacy claim in 3.2400 as whenever we're determining the applicability. So it was.
But it focuses on what the initial decision is. So that's a term of art. That's a question. I mean, if this dispute is about the effective date, the June 2014 rating decision didn't touch that, right? That didn't happen until June of 2021, and right. Then again in April of 2022.
Right, and so again, my friend said during his opening that he was not arguing that the June 21 grant of TDIU was the initial decision. I think we all agree that the initial decision is the one that is the initial one on the claim, and then the downstream issues of when this case only effective date for TDIU still are under the legacy system until a claimant takes the step of opting in. So the June 21 decision, while it did assign an effective date, it couldn't have been the initial decision because, as you said, there were many steps previously in the legacy claim stream prior to that June 21 grant and assignment of an effective date in TDIU. And something that that Judge Bartley said a minute ago I think is important too is that if we accept this argument, then opting in is meaningless. You don't have to opt in. You can wait. And so every other claimant who lost out or chose not to and went through the legacy system, well, they're being treated differently than this rule that they're espousing, where actually the 60 days after you receive an SSOC is not the time frame, even though that's what Congress instructed the secretary to prescribe. You can actually wait for a year after your legacy board decision or your legacy rating decision becomes final. And this court has said numerous times that we cannot take a reading of the law that makes other provisions of the same law redundant. And so that's what this argument does, is that it makes the opt-in procedure not the only way, even though that's what Congress said was the way. And so when you read these statutes in context and in as a whole, it becomes clear that once a claim becomes final in the legacy system, the options are limited. But veterans are given notice after every SOC and every SSOC that if you want the benefits of the AMA and expressly says one of the benefits includes potentially preserving your effective date back to the initial date of claim, then you need to take one of these steps to do so. And so that is an indication that later options that are later steps taken are not going to be accepted as an opt-in. And as my friend has said, they're not arguing that the supplemental claim was a late opt-in that could possibly be some sort of a waiver. They're saying that on the text of 2X1 alone, that this triggers application of the AMA, and that just cannot square with the rest of the law, especially because the entire phrase in 2X1 says explicitly except as otherwise provided in this subsection. That's Congress's indication to us and to veterans that this rule has an exception to it. And that exception is that if you want a legacy claim to get the benefits of this new system, then you have to opt in.
It seems like you're answering this question both yes and no. So I'll ask it in a way that I hope is clearer. And that is, does this case turn on the distinction between opting for an AMA decision review docket lane means action, I think is the actual law that the statute says, or expressly opting in to the AMA? Does that what the case turns on?
I think it's the latter, and I think it's the latter during the time frame allotted in the regulations, which in 3.2400, we say that veterans can opt into the AMA within the time for taking an appeal under 19.52B, which is the 60 days following the rating decision. And so because he didn't take that affirmative step, affirmative action, of filing one of the review options under 3.2500 within the time that he was notified was permissible, then the claim stayed in the legacy system. And then once he filed this later, that started a new claim stream. But again, the supplemental claim, or what kind of supplemental claim it's going to be, turns on the decision being challenged. And so the board recognized that and said, you filed a supplemental claim on a final legacy board decision that's adjudicated the effective date for TDIU, and those sorts of claims are impermissible. Let me see if there was anything. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, under the law stated in Calhoun and in Rudd and in Leonard, the court should affirm the board's dismissal of appellant's April 22 supplemental claim as a freestanding early effective date claim.
Thank you, Mr. LeBlanc. Mr. Stoltz, you may move ahead with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address my colleague's reading of the public law. And when the public law was passed, it gave shape to the fact that we were going to have these different systems running for just a little while, the legacy system and the AMA. And nothing that my colleague says in this section in my reading limits the only way in to the AMA to just be the opt-in. To accept the Secretary's point, I believe the court has to read out the plain language of 2X, which is that all decisions after February 2019, all AOJ decisions after 2019 are in the AMA. If it is in the AMA, it's not, there's no question he could opt in. That is a thing veterans could do. It's not that that is the only way. And the way the Secretary reads the public law, which is giving shape to this, is the only way in is an opt-in after the supplemental claim. And that's just not right, not according to the way the plain language of the public law reads. And it's not just, again, that we're hanging our hat only on the public law. That is the trigger. Really importantly, in this case, and vital to this case, is that a question has to be asked, what version, and I didn't hear anything from the Secretary's counsel that makes me change my opinion, that some version of 5110, because you have to adjudicate an effective date of the claim, right? That's just a thing that you got to do in the VA system, is establish an effective date. And there's nothing that has been cited that can be convincing that, okay, what he filed came after a legacy board decision. And even though it is an AMA decision, for some reason, and he relies on Max and some case law, so I'm not saying that it's coming out of the clear blue sky, but for some reason, 5110 in the legacy system would apply for Mr. Barringer, not 5110 in the AMA. And that, when we talk about not being able to read the statutory framework in harmony, that is the part that is not harmonized in the Secretary's argument. We are simply following the plain language, and I know that the Secretary is reading the except as provided as just saying only you can opt in, but that's not the way the statute reads in its entirety, and it's not the way 5110 should have worked in this case. And so for those reasons and all those reasons pled in our opening and reply briefs, we would encourage this court to vacate the board's decision and remand with an instruction to apply the proper statutory framework. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Stolz. And the court thanks both parties for their arguments. The case is submitted for consideration and the court is adjourned.